So at some point in time, we would want our government to look forward like 10 years, wouldn't that be a radical idea, and have a plan for energy, have a plan for our exports, because it's going to happen anyway and people are going to be severely disrupted if our government doesn't take some form of leadership.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week, our topic is climate change, and my guest is Kelly O'Shaughnessy. Kelly heads up the Australian Conservation Foundation, one of the environment groups active in Australia. In this conversation, we'll hear about the environment movement's plans to make the looming federal election a poll on climate action, and we'll think about a few other things besides. Listen up. Well, Kelly, thank you very much for joining Australian Politics Live.
Thanks for inviting me.
So we heard you at the National Press Club this week. The Australian Conservation Foundation came to Canberra and you addressed the club to outline why this looming federal election sometime over the next however many months has to be a climate change election. So tell me about that. Why does this election have to be a climate change election?
Well, really because we're seeing climate damage happening right now. So the damage from warming the planet is starting to happen now. And look, many of us thought it would be in future generations. Often people talk about the end of the century, but we're seeing heat waves. We're seeing the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef. We're seeing droughts. We're seeing 47 degrees days in Penrith. And the science actually around climate change and attributing those events to climate change is really quite strong now. So we do know that heat waves and droughts are correlated to climate change. So Aussies are really worried that climate damage is actually here now. Closer to about 80% of Australians are quite worried about that. And so that's one thing. Climate change is here. The other thing is the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, just told us that if we don't act fast and really in the next decade or so, we won't stay below 1.5 degrees of global warming. We're at 1 degree now and we're seeing climate damage, so it's not safe. 1.5 is definitely not safe. Mm-hmm. And the only way that we stay below 1.5 is to really shift away from burning coal really over the next 12 years. Not completely, but about 70 to 80% of our coal we need to stop burning that much globally and in this country. So if climate damage is here now and we've only got a short amount of time, then the next government of Australia really matters, and therefore the federal election really matters. So we want people to know that their vote is very powerful, and who they vote for in this next election will help determine whether we have a safe climate future or not.
And just with I hear what you say about the urgency, obviously. I mean, anybody following this debate knows that this is urgent, and we are, by all the faffing around, absolutely running out of time, right? So I get that. Is there any merit, though? I remember very clearly, almost as if it were yesterday, sorry to bore the pants off everyone, the 2007 election, which may have different dynamics to this one, but I do remember it very clearly, and that shift that John Howard made in the lead up to the 2007 election. Coincidentally, there was a drought. Coincidentally, it's sort of climatic conditions similar to what we're seeing now. Is there an opportunity for the movement? I've paid urgency, right? I've paid the substantive point that we can't muck around anymore. We have to sort this out. But politically, is this ripe? Is this environment ripe for trying to win hearts and minds on this issue?
I think it is. Like, I think hearts and minds were won on the issue in 2007. I remember holding a rally, Walk Against Warmings back then, and we had the biggest rally ever in the lead up to that federal election to say now is the time. But so 50,000 people on the streets, that's great. But what really matters is having quite organised power. We need organised people power, because what we found is we could win policy outcomes with one government and then the next government would just come in and unwind it. We've seen that with the Abbott government et al. And they unwound the carbon price, and ever since then emissions have gone up. So the environment movement at that time did not have the power to get climate policy outcomes no matter which party was in power and elected in government. And that just doesn't work with global warming because, as you mentioned, we are running out of time. So since then, we started building that people power up. And it's a long, hard slog to do. You know, you can have a lot of people on your side, and we do. We have 500,000 people and counting. But really, you need that deep organised power in the seats that really matter, that the parties will fight over to win, and we want that ambition to be over climate change. So we've definitely been here before on climate ambition and climate discussion in the country. And then, you know, it really wavered when people got confused out in the world when Abbott said, you know, what did he say? Climate was BS or...
Two issues that Abbott... There was sort of... a sustained questioning of the science that occurred in sections of the coalition. But where Abbott turned the carbon pricing debate against Labor was turning it into a cost of living issue. He turned it away from an environment, an issue of the environment and an environmental stewardship and climate change action into a hip pocket issue. And that's where the debate turned. That was... So, you know, it's the difficulty of this issue is that we repeat and repeat these cycles, and we're in a similar cycle with the coalition now.
Luckily, actually, one thing has changed since then, which is clean energy is now cheaper than a new coal plant. So the economics are on the side. Although, God, if we are running this, if we think about only economics when it comes to solving climate change, we are going to be stuffed, because solving climate change might be affordable for clean energy, but it's not going to be cheap. We've got all of the agriculture and transport and industry. We've got all these big things we need to do. We can build a stronger economy. And in fact, if you don't act, our economy is going to be tanked anyway. But I am a little bit over politicians only thinking through the economic prism. They kind of forget that we live on a planet and that provides everything. And society then runs an economy to transition goods and services. I know it's more complicated than that. But that's why we're trying to talk through climate damage being here now and talking about a lot. I'm sure the National Press Club has never had love as much in the speech as I mentioned it, because for the people that we love and the places that we love, we know that worked really well with the hearts and minds of Australians. And if they look at their kid in the eye and know that their vote can make a difference in their lives, for climate change or not, we think we can get more people supporting parties that stronger climate policies.
I get why the imperative of building ground up. I totally get that, because you guys have kicked around these policy debates in Canberra for 30 years, 30 years basically, through all the iterations of this debate. You've worked these corridors extensively over a long period of time, and the story, sadly, has been some progress but a lot of disappointment. So I get why you would want to then turn the focus back to the community and say, well, if you've got parliamentary deadlock, if you've got a dysfunctional polity in terms of what happens here in Canberra, you've got to build up from the ground. You've got to activate the community because that's the only way to puncture the deadlock, right? If the people's electoral fortunes are on the line. So the logic of that's impeccable. But at some point, though, we still come back to the parliament and we still come back to this sort of seemingly irresolvable conflict between sections of the Liberal Party and other more progressive actors in the parliament. So can you tell me how we fix that? Because I've spent 20 years on it and I don't know.
You know, the world does progress. You know, there was parties that would have supported tobacco and smoking back in the day, and they progress and change their minds. So it's a long, hard slog. It does happen. I just think that pollies that are denying that climate change is real, for starters, which we have a number in the current government, are going to become irrelevant. And I'd be very interested to see what's going to happen with their seats. You know, we're talking about Warringah with independents running. What happens in Wentworth is a classic example. Not that the politicians that are running there were denying climate change, but their party was pretty adamantly against any action. So I just think become irrelevant as a political party. If it's not this election, it'll be the next election. It is inevitable that it will happen, that the Liberal Party and the National Party will move on their climate policies. And I think one way I know that is because they kind of already are on clean energy. They talk about it being part of the toolbox now, rather than it being this horrid thing that knocks over power lines in South Australia. And now the line is, well, it's a part of the toolbox and it should just stack up against everything else. But if you set reliability measures and cost affordability measures and not an emission measure, you're not putting them all on a level playing field. Mm-hmm. And coal is polluting and clean energy isn't. So you need those emissions targets. So I just think that's why we work in those marginal seats. We're often really progressive candidates will be for the Liberal Party, and they will be forcing their own party to move forward on their policy, and they just need to be louder than the naysayers in the party. One thing I think is really disappointing with the Liberal coalition or Liberal National coalition is, where are the moderates? Where have they been over the last 4 years?
Well, look, I agree. And some of them, I mean, to be fair to them, were active during the debate around the National Energy Guarantee. They were active and they tried to give Josh Frydenberg quite a lot of support in order to try and get that policy legislated, even with its very substantial flaws. But it's in terms of this point, though, about community activism and you say time will basically get rid of politicians who are anti-science, anti-fact, anti-reason. I hope you're right. But
or they'll move.
Well,
yeah, move their positions.
But there's another difficulty, though, and you can put this a little bit too starkly, because I think things in regional Australia, which I think we are both from, I think things are changing in the bush. I do. I really, and quite quickly. But it's almost like, and I don't think we're as bad as America, but there's slightly the two countries phenomenon here, or three countries or four countries. Now, what I mean by that is you can exert pressure with moderate progressive liberals in inner metropolitan seats or even outer metro seats and get them to stand up on the science of climate change. But then you've got problems in Queensland, regional Queensland coal communities, problems in coal communities around the country. Then you've got parties that have got genuine representative problems, right? You've got to represent the sensibilities in metropolitan Australia, and you've also got to look after people in regional communities who may have different attitudes to climate change than people in the cities. Again, that's difficult. So how do you deal with that?
I think you have to help people understand how they'll be better off in a future that is with less warming. So I'm really excited to see the National Farmers Federation come out so strongly on climate change over the last year or so. It's so important. Yeah, it's wonderful. And I think that their constituencies wanted that for a long time. We work with farmers very deeply, helped form Landcare about 26 or 7 years ago with the NFF. But it's wonderful they're coming out, because it is showing that, for example, the National Party are probably not really representing many of the people that are voting for them. So I think that, and they're seeing that because they've got these droughts. There's a farmer who was on ABC recently who was showing what he's doing to deal with drought, which is putting solar and wind farms in, which is a problem, right? It's great for him and his family, but we need food and food security. That's not the answer. So for farmers, they're speaking up now because they're seeing the impact. For people who live out in the regional suburbs, that live close to the bush, they're now having to worry about fires in winter and what might happen.
And water and all of those things.
How are our lives better off if we deal with climate change? And there's the negative side to that, which is, well, what could it otherwise be? Today we released some information about Cook and what might happen in the seat of Cook, which is Prime Minister's electorate, without any further action. And there's going to be 48 more days over 30 degrees by 2050. So a child born today will experience very, very different seasons. They won't really experience a winter. They'll have 7.5 months of summer and an extreme summer. So let's make it real for people. And it's not the next generation. It's not the end of the century. It's right now. And that's why I think we're facing a very different time, different focus now, because we are seeing climate damage now, and communities see it. And the people who are feeling it the most, like the farming community, have more concern. So the percentage of people out in the rural and regional Australia that are concerned are often higher than in urban.
Well, and it's growing, which is good. But then we get to coal communities.
Yes.
And this is the difficulty. Like the logic of make it real for people is impeccable until you make it real for the coal community, who's you know, livelihoods are on the way out. Mm. Now, in Australia, we used to be very good at economic transformation. In fact, we used to pride ourselves on being very good at this.
I can't remember those days. Well, but
it's not that long ago. Yeah. I think we were both alive. But anyway, we did pride ourselves on that. It was something that we used to do very well. And something we did well in this country because there was a social compact between governments and citizens, so there would be, you know, people would be gotten through these transitions. We find now that governments are much less inclined to take on those sorts of fights because, of course, we're 30 years down the road on those fights and everyone you have gets harder. But this one's massive, isn't it? Because Australia is so carbon intensive. We have a massive coal industry. We are also reliant on those export dollars for well-being.
Mm-hmm.
We need to make this transition, but you've got a practical sell job with coal communities to say, well, look, sorry guys, coal out, wind farms in, pity about your jobs. And then you've got the national economic arguments to win as well. So how do we do that?
Yeah, there's a lot of arguments to win, there's no doubt about it. So today there's also the CFMEU or the CFMMMEU.
Yeah, it's two M's now, I think.
I haven't got that one right
double
yet.
M's.
But
yep.
They are releasing some research that talks about that transition and the need for a national transition authority for energy. So there's a phased and planned closure for coal stations. So we've already got the unions, you know, of Australia saying there needs to be a phased closure of our coal-fired power stations. Coal workers that I've spoken to are saying the same thing. And they know the writing on the wall. They know that there is over a couple of decades at least, we need to, you know, make that a little bit faster, but there is a structural decline of thermal coal.
Mm.
And their jobs are going and they want jobs. So there needs to be this transition plan to look after them. We absolutely back that. But it's actually really quite complicated because there's about 24 odd coal plants, something around them, 23, 24 in Australia. To stay below 1.5, we need to shut the equivalent of about 12 of those in 12 years.
It's a lot.
It is a lot. And so it does need that plan. And there needs to be investment in those communities, not just in the workers either, but it's the people that
The secondary
that's
who rely on those, rely on that economy.
Yeah, and you know, you look at some towns are going to be easier to transition than others because they have big ports. They could be looking at exporting renewable hydrogen, for example.
Mm.
I know there's discussion on that up in Gladstone in Queensland at the moment, which has a big coal plant that will shut. Hazelwood and Latrobe is a bit harder because it doesn't have as much sunshine, doesn't have necessarily all those natural advantages. So you have to work a lot harder to look after those communities. But I remember when Hazelwood closed, there was a fellow who worked there, a very highly skilled coal worker, and he said, I got a text message, told me it was going to close. I mean, he kind of expected it because we've been talking about it for years. But to find out via text message is a terrible, terrible thing, and they've already gone through adjustments in the past down there in the Latrobe Valley. So we've got to really care for these communities. But look, it's happening. We can't ignore this big transition away from coal that's happening globally. And people keep pinpointing to, oh, look, price, you know, this week is up, or, you know, China's got a lot of coal plants on the books that they haven't built, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That might be on the books, but they're not getting built. So at some point in time, we would want our government to look forward like 10 years, wouldn't that be a radical idea, and have a plan for energy, have a plan for our exports, because it's going to happen anyway and people are going to be severely disrupted if our government doesn't take some form of leadership.
Well, that's the options, isn't it? Like it's disruption that's completely unmanaged, or it's disruption that is managed.
Like our coal plants are really old, so they are going to close. No doubt about it. We want them to close a bit faster than they otherwise would. But most of them, you know, a whole huge chunk of them will be shut by mid-2030 with no change. So the choice is, what do you replace them with? And we know clean energy is cheaper and healthier for people. So I don't even understand why there's a debate around that.
Mm.
The debate should be, well, we need to accelerate that closure because we won't otherwise reach 1.5 degrees. And the experts tell us that hundreds of millions of people's lives we at risk if we don't stay below 1.5 degrees. I reckon that's a pretty good reason to have a debate around climate change and the accelerated closure of coal plants.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned at when you were at the press club, obviously it's quite difficult for someone in your position to reflect, well, let's call it constructively, on what the movement might or might not have done perfectly in the past. I wanted to draw you out a little bit on that because I think that's quite important. So if I understood you correctly, and by the movement, I should say to the listeners, I'm talking about the environment movement here. Mm-hmm. So what the environment movement has done over the various iterations of the climate change debate over the last how many years. So what do you think has not been done well? I think at the club you said, I'll say it more bluntly than you did, that the perfect has been made the enemy of the good too often, or on a couple of crucial occasions. Is that it, or is it more than that?
I think it is more than that. That is definitely it. And, you know, with 2020 hindsight, you say, well, would the CPRS been a good thing to mm-hmm. do? Would we even have a carbon trading scheme if Howard got re-elected? You know, not that we had a role in his demise or not, but, you know, the mind boggles when you can look back with 2020 hindsight. So I do think that many of us wait for the perfect policy outcome. And I reckon just let's get this ball rolling, and it will roll really fast because the economics now stack up, the momentum in the community, state and local government are all stacking up in business. They're not going to invest in a coal plant. So it's all there. So I think I did really mean that. But the other thing, and I want people to know we're not perfect at all. And we're struggling with the complexity of these transitions along with everyone else. And I'll look at the tweets I get after my press club, and there'll be a lot of angry people telling me I'm a moron or a Puritan. So we really want to make that point that we know we're not. But back in CPRS days,
This is the carbon pollution reduction scheme, just in case you don't know.
Mark number one of our big climate policy
Kevin
in this
Rudd.
Country. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our movement was very split on that policy. Actually, ACF, I wasn't there at the time, did support that policy, but most of the movement did not. And I still don't know what the right call on that is. There were parts of that policy that were very problematic that were fixed in the second round. But we are much more united now. So we actually develop our policies together in the environment movement now. We all have the same goals. We have alliances around repowering the country with 100% renewables by 2030, which is ambitious but technically possible. We have alliances around stopping the Adani coal mine. We don't want to just stop the Adani coal mine. We don't want the Galilee Basin up, but we just don't want any new coal mines, thermal coal mines built. But we focus on the Adani one because that's a huge one if it starts. So we're actually very aligned. The alignment's never been, as far as I'm told, never has been as strong as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe back in the days of the Franklin, were another great victory. They were, although I hear lots of little stories of how groups used to argue about where they'd set up their camps. So maybe there were big disagreements back then. But it's really strongly aligned. And I think, that alignment is really important for us to determine what policy outcomes are good for this country.
Well, it's certainly better. I'll chip you slightly on we're all aligned. Not so aligned during the debate about the National Energy Guarantee. And just as a person who's followed this issue over a very long period of time, one thing that was really starkly, if that's even a word, noticeable to me during that debate was there was a bit of a gap between people who had been at this rodeo before, people who had been around through the iterations of the carbon pricing scheme and the renewable energy fight and various other things, and people who had not. And this is a gross generalisation, but people who had been around a bit were inclined to let that policy, with its flaws, and they were deep flaws, go through on the basis that it was could be scaled up. People who had not been through the various iterations were, oh, no, death upon your person, nick off. Look, you can set too much store, and I totally agree with you that the call on the carbon pollution reduction scheme was a far more consequential one than the one on the National Energy Guarantee, which was not a great policy. But I saw quite obvious differences during the National Energy Guarantee debate, and they weren't particularly constructive, and it didn't help. It didn't help ultimately. Fine for the movement to say this policy stinks on X, Y, and Z levels, ambitions, crap, whatever you want to say, all those are legitimate points. But there were people around the movement trying to rip this down, thinking that in some future fantasy parliament, perhaps the renewable energy target would be rolled over by some future fantasy parliamentarians. And it's sort of like, again, allow me, sorry, just vent a small amount of frustration as someone who has been at the rodeo for a little while. It's sort of like, I think, watching it, why on earth did these lessons have to keep being relearned? Why on earth can this not be built into the muscle memory? And that's not me saying, the environment movement created these problems. The environment movement has not created these problems. But I'm just saying there are differences. I know you're here telling me there's not, and you're working together, and you, and doubtless you are.
Yeah.
But you sure you've got this under?
No, we haven't. Mm-hmm. So there is greater unity, but there will always be difference. There are always smaller groups or individuals who are going to have a difference. We always know what they are, and they strategically share that with us. But we do share the same goals, the same policy agenda on climate change in this country through the Climate Action Network of Australia. And I reckon the NEG's a really good point. But there was a strategy behind that that we devised together. And, you know, just before I finish on the difference is not always in where we're trying to achieve, it's how we achieve it. So ACF is a very strong theory of change, which is about building people power and in this country, and changing the hearts and minds through the words we use, the stories we tell, the media that we generate in this country. Other groups have very different change strategies, and we know that, and we try and work them together. So on the NEG, first of all, you know, it was about the fifth time at a policy and they kept getting worse. In the end, what we said at the start was, I say, it's going to take clean energy backwards in Australia. So how can an environment group support it?
Very difficult.
But what we said is, so states and territories work to make it better. Mm-hmm. And we met with all the states and territories, and the movement met with all the states and territories. ACF did, GetUp did, Greenpeace did. We all met. And I think the states and territories did put a lot of pressure on ramping up the climate elements and the ambition. But in the end, we made a decision that we were not going to get any more ambition on climate change in with the current government before any election. So why don't we just say, put the target in a regulation and let the next government up that target. Mm-hmm. And so all the groups signed on to a submission with that, and then we met with the state saying, this is our bottom line. You know, we'd love you to do all of these things, but just do that one thing. So we did compromise in the end, but we don't do that at the start because we want to get the best outcome that we possibly can. There's a strategy behind it.
Of course.
And GetUp and Greenpeace funded some ads in Victoria that were quite scathing of the Victorian government if they didn't support stronger targets. We didn't do that, but we knew they were doing that. ACF, you know, prefers to make change in a different way, so we have those different change strategies. But Victoria was very strong, ACT was very strong, South Australia and Queensland. And, you know, if the Liberal Party hadn't imploded, perhaps we might have had a NEG with an ambition target in the regulation, and then we would be running our campaign that we're running now just to raise the ambition. So what's really interesting at the moment, though, is ACF is a member of the Australian Climate Roundtable, which has got business and peak bodies, unions and social groups, and we're all aligned on the NEG, and we're all aligned on emissions have to be part of the energy problem. So this unity of at the base level is very strong,
but if
the government changes, or if the next government has very strong climate policies, isn't going to get serious on energy transition, it's going to be really tough. Once you've got the ear of government, that's when the splits kind of happen in the movement.
Oh, of course.
So we need to be as strong as possible together, and not let the perfect get in the way of the good, because that's just not how change happens.
Amen to that. Just quickly before we wrap up, the Charities Act. Now, the ACF is a charity, obviously, and you are planning on taking a pretty muscular campaign, I think, at the coming election, working in marginal seats, a couple of that you've already identified, presumably more to come. It's a fine line, isn't it, between issues activism and partisanship, probably less, it might be less fine than it looks, but stepping outside politics for people watching inside, it's tricky, isn't it, where you strike that balance. So is the ACF completely confident that the campaign that you already have in motion and will have in motion over the next several months will conform with the restrictions you face under the Charities Act?
Yeah, so charities aren't able to be partisan in Australia, but they can be political. So you can get involved in political issues and have a view on the issue, but not on which party or candidate should be elected. So there, it's not that fine the line because there's a lot of guidance from the Australian Charities Not-for-Profit Commission. So what ACF does is walk all the way up to that line, which is pretty clearly defined for us, and we look at it and we don't step over it, but we're going all the way up there because we're facing, you know, it's life or death, this climate change business. So.
Well, and of course, in a robust democracy, civil society needs to be able to raise its voice. Otherwise, you know, you're living in something that isn't a democracy. So
that's right. And it's no different to what the advocacy has always done that. We've always advocated for what should be. And I just think issues like climate change are incredibly partisan and just bloody hard to solve, you know, especially if you don't like to think more than a few years ahead, which, you know, a lot of political parties get caught in those cycles. So it has meant that governments like the current government that don't like what we're doing have just attacked our ability to be a charity. And they've lost every time they've done that because other charities are sticking up for us.
Well, yes. Well, let's talk about unity in a sector. Yeah. Good heavens. That's amazing to see how the charities have rallied. Yeah. But does it make it more difficult? Because obviously the coalition has this campaign asymmetry. This is part of the reason why we've heard a lot about this in recent times. I mean, obviously, sorry, I should make clear that it's good if you actually obey the law. I'm not suggesting
very
that
important.
People act
yep.
lawlessly. But one of the reasons this has been raised as an issue is because the progressive side of politics has got a better field infrastructure, campaign infrastructure, than the conservative side of politics in this country. So we've had a lot of attention on what activist groups like the ACF are doing. Does that attention make it more difficult to run an election campaign of the type you're currently contemplating?
Look, it probably does for most groups because under these threats of by the current government on removing charitable status for groups like ACF or international donations for other advocacy organisations, which doesn't affect ACF, we don't have international donations, that has silenced a number of groups. We know it scared a lot of groups. It makes us double down at ACF. It just kind of pisses us off and just say, well, you know, we are allowed to do this. This is lawful and you're really putting the lives of Australians at risk by ignoring climate change. So this is the time in which we will act and act all the way up to where we can. And I actually think, you know, organisations like ACF are unable to break the law. It's very important that we don't. But individuals across Australia are going to make the decision to do peaceful but unlawful protest if the Adani coal mine starts getting built. I mean, they did it in the Franklin. That's an individual choice they make. But I, for one, think it's quite heroic that individuals put their future on the line by saying, this coal mine is so dangerous to our future that I'm going to go and lock on. And we now look back at the people who did that on the Franklin and say, thank God you did that because we have this beautiful river. I'm probably not the type of person who's going to do that, but I really admire the people who do. I'm the CEO of ACF. Even if I did it as an individual, the organisation would get pinged, so it's never going to be me. But I think we shouldn't look at them and call them terrible names because they've protected the Great Barrier Reef from limestone mining and the Franklin from being dammed. They got Kakadu as a national park, and they will probably stop the Adani coal mine if
that's where
sod is
up.
Turned over there.
Well, that's probably a good note to end up on. Watch this space, people. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thank you to Hannah, as always, for production services, Sterling Production Services to APL. Thanks to the listeners. Don't forget to subscribe if you like the listening and share these conversations with your friends. It does improve the visibility of the project and means that we can keep doing it, basically. Until next week, be well.